The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Thursday, July 28th, 2016. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the inside the hall of the Democratic National Convention 2016 in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Ladies and gentlemen, it is day, I don't know, it feels like 15 of the Democratic National Convention. It's actually day four, I believe, technically speaking. And tonight we'll hear from Chelsea Clinton, Hillary Clinton. Last night we heard from the vice presidential nominee, Tim Kaine, the sitting vice president, Joe Biden. We heard from the sitting president, Barack Obama. And we also heard from Michael Bloomberg. Yes,
you
I had to
pieces
do.
Of garbage.
That's right. Here to talk to us about that is one of the sharpest political minds. I'm not joking about this. He's looking at me. And I honestly, one of the sharpest political minds. I feel like I have not just know, like, because I obviously take in a lot of people's opinions of people I don't know. But one of the sharpest political minds I'm aware of. Michael Schur, you know him from the TYT. You know him from maybe Al Jazeera.
Probably TYT.
Yeah. And he's here with BitTorrent as well. The legal BitTorrent, right? Like the
The legit BitTorrent. They've turned over a new leaf, and they're trying to get into content, and they're covering very aggressively. We've been to both conventions, and it's been an interesting ride. It feels like it's been, I mean, if you think it feels like, and I know because the Dem feels even longer than the Republican just because everything's so spread out and it's so damn hot here, but we've been going for quite a while on this convention.
Yeah, you're going to collapse, aren't
you? Yeah, I'm going to collapse, but I also, I was saying this to someone else, it's great to complain about it, right?
Right.
Next week in the middle of the week, I'll be saying, it's four more years until we do a convention. I think you and I were talking about that before. When you get geeked about this stuff,
right,
you like it. And even though so much of it is ridiculous, if I weren't here, I would be so upset right now.
Right, right. All right, well, so compare and contrast the two conventions. I mean, there's obviously, there's plenty of contrast.
Of course. I mean, there's the political contrast. There's the content contrast. You know, Sam, one of the things that I think is so weird about the Republicans, who are so good at messaging and so good at image, is that they don't have proportionally more delegates. Their hall is emptier because there are, in fact, raw number fewer delegates. It seems like it's the easiest thing in the world to correct. Just add some delegates proportionally. Here, by virtue of the fact there are a couple of thousand more delegates, the hall just seems much more electric. And that, to me, is one of the big differences between – it was one of the big differences between Tampa and Charlotte in 2012. It's one of the big differences this year between Cleveland and Philadelphia as well.
I mean, it's fascinating how something that is I guess there is actually – it's not just cosmetic, right? I mean,
right,
you actually are bringing more people into the process. But – It's amazing how much that matters for something like this.
Yeah, it's true, because this is a television event. And the energy in the hall translates to the people in the hall, but it also translates to the country. And, you know, you're sitting here on Radio Row, you're hearing 1,000 different languages walk by here, too. People doing TV and radio reports in so many different languages. So it seems like an easy fix.
Yeah, and it's also, I mean, one of the things that strikes me about this is it is a made-for-TV event, yet the reporters and the media that cover it are not experiencing it like the people who actually it's meant for.
Right.
And it's rare that we have that type of situation, because you almost, normally the way it works with reporting is you go to an event and that's how you relate what's happening to the audience. But really what's happening is actually the TV experience.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. And, you know, at Al Jazeera, one of the sort of interesting things that they did when we were there for the debates was they kept a correspondent at home watching the debate on television, as opposed to those of us who were there and experiencing it. And even if you're outside the debate, because usually, let's say NBC was putting on the debate, only NBC reporters could be inside the hall. And Al Jazeera wasn't asked to put on any debates this cycle. It is such a different experience seeing it from the outside than from the inside. And also, you have all the partisans inside, so they're going to get excited about everything that's said. You
know? That I mean, I have to say, like, that was I went and did one of those debates. I wasn't in the hall. I was outside in the media, and it was fascinating to watch the groupthink that takes that inevitably takes place. And you know, like here, if the air conditioning goes off, You'll have a bunch of people walking around going like, this is a disaster.
Right.
It has no relationship whatsoever to what's going on.
That's true.
All right. So give me your sense of last night.
Here's the thing. I thought, you know, the oratory was exquisite for most of the night. I think Joe Biden gave a great finale speech to a spectacular career, a bittersweet life, and all of the things. I mean, this is his exit speech, in a sense, one would think, and I think he did it really well. A couple of questions I had, or one question I had going into these last two nights was, are they going to go at Donald Trump directly, or are they going to dance around it the way John Kerry often danced around things or ignored things when he ran for the presidency in 2004? And I think that there were two schools of thought. One is, if you are dignified and you take the high road and you avoid the low road, that there's currency to be gained there. With Donald Trump, you really have to get into the trenches with him. And so I was hoping that they would have gone right at him. And you knew from the moment the evening started, when you had other of these sort of lesser, quote-unquote lesser speakers going right at him, that was setting a tone. And then Joe Biden took it right to him. And they made it seem imperative, you know, that we not elect Donald Trump before they said it's imperative that we do elect Hillary Clinton. I thought that was good stagecraft as well. So that being said, I think that the role of last night was to set up the need for Hillary Clinton and that there was a team behind her. There's been a sort of sense, because she isolates herself for a variety of reasons, some legitimate, some understandable, some ridiculous, but she isolates herself. And there's now a sense, I think, among Democrats and I think among the media, that she has a lot of people behind her and important people. You could tell that Barack Obama, after last night, is excited to campaign again. He had a swagger on. So, and all, listen, I'm not someone who believes these conventions matter at all. I don't think that, you know, I think what do? You defuse a bump that Trump got. I don't even care about next week's polls. I care about the polls in 3 weeks. I think those are the ones that are going to start to shape the election, where they campaign, what issues play out for the 2 months that after that. But I do think that it's reassuring to a lot of Democrats to see people they actually like say this so passionately and sort of commit to doing this. And I think that happened last night.
Is it reassuring insofar as that they're going to be campaigning, or is there also sort of a sense of, I mean, as you say this, I mean, I wonder if to a certain extent there's a gender issue here, that there is a sense like, we've got to, you know, anybody who's worried about maybe like some level, like, you know, has a hard time envisioning a woman being president. We just want to make it clear, like, all the guys are here.
Yeah, that's interesting.
It didn't occur to me until you were actually saying that.
Right.
I've heard it now mentioned a couple of times, like, she's going to have a president in the White House if she becomes president, a former president, and a former president down the block.
Right.
Who's staying because Obama's going to be in Washington. That's a lot of former presidents within, like, 15 minutes.
And it makes her the first person to become president who's sort of beholden to two, for very, very different reasons, two former presidents. It makes it very difficult.
In terms
of
maintaining legacies.
Yeah, maintaining legacies. And also defining herself. You know, take an issue like TPP, for example, and there are a number of issues. The crime bill with Bill Clinton. She was married to Bill Clinton. By default, she is supporting her husband. We've never, until that time, or until now maybe even, I don't even know if we do now, ask of our first spouses to have an opinion that differs with their spouse's opinion. So you could say, oh, look what happened. There was a crime bill. There was NAFTA. Hillary Clinton was at home or doing things having to do with being First Lady while she was at that White House. So to say that she had a hand in the crime bill, she was an activist First Lady. But to put all the blame on that, similarly with TPP. Now, I'm not excusing it, but when you're part of an administration and you're in charge of international trade because the State Department oversees that, you know, the Commerce Department to a degree does too, but it's in a different way in terms of negotiating trade deals. They're not part of that. When you're doing that and you work for a president, you can resign. You can say, no, I don't like TPP. I'm done. Hillary Clinton's not going to do that. So you go along with the administration. So what I mean is it's a very complicated thing to be running for president when you have you're trying to curate two legacies and you're also, you know, inextricably linked with two of them as well.
That's interesting. Yeah, I mean, it's last night it struck me. I mean, they did go directly at Trump. I mean, they even wheeled out Michael Bloomberg to do that.
Did you think he was effective?
You know, I was a lot more skeptical about it. I don't like the idea of him being there, but just in general, I don't like his presence, period, anywhere. But I think he was probably pretty effective at it. And I think the what struck me, though, is... And Bloomberg sort of was the template for this. You say, you know, they talked about Trump in terms of, like, it's urgent to vote against him.
Yeah.
And then they made the affirmative case. But, like, the first case, like, it's almost like we don't even need to get to who you're going to be voting for.
Right.
It's urgent you vote against. There is, you know, I mean, maybe this is just, you know, if it was a convention aimed at Sam Cedar, as opposed to anybody else. Although, I do lament the fact that we do not have, even broadly speaking, an ideological distinction. Because, you know, the fact is that Donald Trump, if he's president, he's going to appoint Supreme Court justices I don't like.
Right.
Ted Cruz would do the same. Jeb Bush would do the same. Every single one of those Republicans would have done the exact same.
But he's the guy on stage now.
He's the guy on stage, but my point is that they're not making a case, a proactive case, not just for, I mean, they are to a certain extent with Hillary, but there's no proactive case for supposedly what the Democrats are standing for in any way, shape, or form, and they don't seem to be creating a significant distinction.
Well, I think I'm going to differ with you on part of that and agree with you on most of it, but the part that I disagree with, this is really the first time that I remember the Supreme Court, not that it's been politicized for years. I've always wondered why it hasn't been more of a campaign issue, because once you sold it down
the
river... on the left, exactly. And they're doing that. To me, that's proactive. To me, that's different. And to me, that's important, especially at a time when, listen, we're on the cusp of 2 to 3 vacancies likely. There's already one, you know. So I think it's also something that's palpable to Americans.
Yeah, I think I was using the Supreme Court as a surrogate for, like, broader issues, which is that, like, a Jeb Bush presidency would look closer to Donald Trump's presidency than certainly even a Hillary Clinton's would look like Jeb Bush's.
Yeah.
Knock on wood. Let's hope. But part of the problem that we have, an ongoing problem, and I understand the urgency of this election, is that, you know, 2 years from now, you're starting at zero in terms of making a broader case to the American public why it's important to go out and vote for a Democrat,
right,
for House or for Senate.
Well, you're making that case, but you're also making that case, in fairness, by bringing Senator Chris Murphy and the anti-gun lobby out onto your stage in a pronounced way, in an enduring way. I think guns have taken more of a role at this convention than they have in a long time. Democrats have tiptoed around that issue. They're not doing that now, and I give them credit for that. I know what you're talking about. I know what's lacking. This could have been a Ronald Reagan speech in a lot of ways that was given last night.
Yep.
It was about the intangible, hopeful, looking at the darkness of the last convention. I think that they had some speeches written before the Republican convention. They did a lot of editing because I think that what they saw was darkness and the chance, in the same way that Ronald Reagan did it to Jimmy Carter, to do it to Donald Trump.
Right, Donald Trump's malaise. All right, well, we just have 3 minutes here with you because I know you're going to go ago. But one thing that we haven't even mentioned, and it didn't even occur to me.
Of course.
It's Tim Kaine.
Tim Kaine, right? I know. In a way, that's just what they want, right? I don't mean to be cynical, but realistic. None of it matters. Tim Kaine doesn't matter. It's the vice presidential night historically. All they can do is screw up. And it's the first choice traditionally that presidents make and or nominees make. Even when it's a bad choice, it usually, if the president is okay enough for them, it'll work. George H.W. Bush is a perfect example. Nominated one of the least qualified vice presidents in Dan Quayle, you know, the one heartbeat away thing, and they still won. You know,
right.
They still beat Dukakis and Benson, and Benson was one of the most sort of traditionally qualified vice presidential candidates in 1988. So you go and you look at it. Did Tim Kaine knock it out of the park? It's a tough crowd. I mean, if you're a comic going on before Eddie Murphy and before Richard Pryor, you're probably, people are going to sit through you, walk out and get a drink, and then wait for the hits. That being said, I think, you know, he gives them what they want. From the Spanish-speaking to the Catholic, which is a subtle outreach to Latin voters to get them to the polls, because so many of them are. I don't think that was overlooked, and it was talked about last night. To saying that he believes. He's somebody who is believable, and he believes in the nominee. That, you know, I don't think you can make a whole lot more of it than that.
Yeah, I mean, there's been one of the major projects, it seems to me, of the convention is to make Hillary Clinton, to humanize her more, to make her more authentic, I guess, and to be more trustful. And
to vouch for her integrity.
To vouch for her integrity. And, you know, that's basically how it works, right? I mean, just even from, screenwriting, you know, it's all in the reaction shots.
That's
it's everybody
exactly
else who's around
right.
there.
Yeah.
And that's it. But Michael Schur, thank you so much for your time today.
Always
I really
love it,
appreciate
Sam.
It.
Anytime you want.
And do you have a website?
No, I have a Twitter, at Michael Schur.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it. Oh, and lastly, you got 60 seconds left. What
happened with Alex Jones? Is that what you're going to ask?
What happened with Alex Jones?
He attacked a set I was on. I'm looking for work, so I didn't want to be part of the story. Ducked away. Was cool, calm, chill. You know, somebody said, look at Michael Schur just in the background. This whole thing's happening. I said, I just want to be the bassist in this band.
Were you live tweeting it?
I tweeted it afterwards. I tweeted a picture of Cenk Uygur and myself beforehand. We each tweeted it's like before the show, and then the after pictures were a little different.
That's
yeah.
That's funny.
It was messy. What were you?
I have
you
not seen him there. I was just going to ask tonight, what does she have to do?
Oh, you know, I mean, listen, she has to do what she was set up to do. She has to make a case for why, even her through her imperfection, I think she has to acknowledge some of the things she has done, but in a broad sense. And she has to sort of be a, you know, it's a terrible thing to say, but we say it about men too, a softer sense of herself.
Mm.
People said that about a lot of it. Al Gore, there was all this caressing
stiff,
of who
yeah,
he was.
Right.
So I don't feel it's sexist to say that. But a lot of people have, there's a barrier between Hillary Clinton and a lot of people. She has to start, it's interesting, he wants to build a wall. She has to start chipping a wall down.
Interesting. Michael Schur, thank you so much. Thanks. I really appreciate it. Thanks. All right, folks. I was anticipating Mark Thompson coming by, but he is not. Oh, someone wants to tell me that they have a guest. I am on the air. And we may have Mark Thompson from SiriusXM may be coming by, but people get waylaid. Happens all the time. This is pretty exciting for the folks in the studio. I was sitting down. I'm sitting next to Fox News Radio. Alan Combs is here. And he sat down with Rob Reiner. And so I just look over. I mean, literally 5 feet away from me. And I look up, having just heard Rob Reiner on that unnamed comedy interview podcast that someone has, WTF. And I look over, and he looks up, and he says, "Hi, Sam, how's it going?" And I almost crap my pants.
You think he listens to the show?
I think he listens to Ring of Fire. Yeah, I think I have that already scheduled.
Maybe Marin has a bunch of buddy pics of you guys around.
Around his...
Yeah.
Yeah, it's possible.
buddy picks.
Really?
No, he doesn't. No, he has a ton of pics of himself around his studio.
Very plausible.
With cats.
So last night I realized that at one point President Obama said the words, the Donald. And I don't know if we talked about this on the show before, but I'm convinced that is the single best way that Democrats should be referring to him. It is, it doesn't sound like they're trying to... sort of steal his shtick by giving him a nickname. It's a pre-existing nickname. And I just think that calling him the Donald just reminds people, like, could you really vote for that? Could you really possibly vote for, like, it's like voting for Barney for president. a cartoon character.
I don't think Barney makes deals.
Barney, of course he does. Barney, who do you think does all that licensing for all the Barney dolls?
Hey, look,
and
I make great deals, okay?
Let's see. Okay. Well, we'll give it another minute or two. Michael, what was your sense of the speech last night?
Of which I actually thought some of the more low profile, like I thought Harry Reid's speech against Donald Trump was incredibly effective. And I like that they gave him an opportunity to do what he did. I thought that my only thought about the Bloomberg speech is that it might actually personally upset Donald Trump himself in terms of the way he questioned his business acumen. And I thought Joe Biden's speech was very, very effective.
Yeah.
I just thought there was something about the way he was able to just say, like, seriously? Like, if you were raised right in any kind of way, you have to be above this almost. And I thought it was effective. And, you know, obviously Obama's a great speaker. I mean, that's just sort of endlessly established, right? So they came out, and I was concerned after last night, or the night before, rather, that they weren't going to be sort of hard enough or tough enough. And I thought they were last night. And I thought Tim Kaine was fine. I thought his Believe Me section was pretty good.
Yeah.
And that whole just contrast, basically, they're just zeroing in on, like, even with Bloomberg, as ridiculous as he is, they basically just had a lineup of, like, here is everybody in American public life who has any, like, shred of credibility with you, and they're saying, how is this even a question by any metric?
Let's play a little bit of sound from Obama's speech. This is where he is basically tipping his hat, as it were, to the Bernie Sanders delegates and supporters, both in the hall and out. Now, I think there's a little bit less of them. A couple hundred of them walked out two nights ago, and I don't believe came back, to be honest with you. But let's play this clip from President Obama.
So if you agree that there's too much inequality in our economy and too much money in our politics, we all need to be as vocal and as organized and as persistent as Bernie Sanders supporters have been during this election. We all need to get out and vote for Democrats up and down the ticket, and then hold them accountable until they get the job done. That's right. Feel the burn.
I mean, it's it was obviously a great sentiment, and it's fascinating to me that it's about, you know, getting the job done without really, again, sort of like avoiding specifically, like, what is the job?
Right. Which job are we doing?
Yes. Yeah. But nevertheless, it's a tip to Bernie supporters. Let me... I have not watched that much of the news coverage, but give me a sense of, like, what sense do people have of what's going on with Bernie supporters here? Because there were a couple of protests. I don't know how much that has gotten onto the news.
My sense of last night from the news I saw was that things had sort of cooled down a bit, that the sort of story of the convention was changing. And that, you know, Obama Obama sort of, even though his politics are obviously much more to the center, kind of right in some ways. I mean, he's popular with everybody, basically. So he was, you know, that. But I think one young woman who actually shouted out in the middle of his speech, she wasn't protesting Bernie. She was protesting and another one was talking about the child refugee issue at the border. So that was significant. But I think like Zad Jilani pointed that out.
There is a couple of protests here yesterday, but a lot of it is turning into sort of grievance stuff,
right,
that I think is, you know, I feel like people got to move on from that. There was actually about a 6 or 7 person silent protest with the tape over the mouths that was actually being held in front of Radio Row. I mean, just put people to pick up on the irony there.
Yeah.
And the lack of efficacy,
right,
of a silent protest that is on Radio Row.
It's kind of Charlie Chaplin-esque.
It's not the best way to go about a protest. All right, joining me now, it is a pleasure to welcome to the program Mark Thompson. He is a host of Make It Plain on Sirius XM, and he's here covering the convention.
Yeah.
Mark,
how are you, man? Good to see you, Sam.
I'm doing great. So, all right, give me your sense. How was last night?
I thought last night was great. Picking up on what you just said, it's hard to reconcile what we witnessed last night, and frankly, what we witnessed all week, and still, you know, be angry or have really a spirit of disunity. And frankly, I mean, we know that there are issues that are left unresolved. You know, I asked some of the people who were very much involved in the Bernie Sanders campaign to kind of give me a percentage or a grade on unity and what Sanders got from Clinton in order to endorse her or to bring about unity. Ben Jealous's opinion was that they got about 90% of what they wanted in the platform. Not 100%, but who gets that? 90% is a good start. I think with what the president even did last night, with this being a pretty seminal moment in history, the first woman, you know, the first African American endorse and stump for the first woman, it's hard to dismiss that. I know there are a lot of things we still need to demand. We need to hold any president accountable. We need to hold,
right,
the Clintons accountable, especially. But I think it dawned on me last night. I think we've got three relevant parties in America, Sam, and all of them on our side. We have the center left wing of the Democratic Party. We have the legitimate left wing of the Democratic Party. That includes people like you and me. And then we've got the Greens. But those are three parties that are on our end of the spectrum. Let's argue, let's debate, let's struggle around our issues, but let's acknowledge that if we want a multi-party democracy, those are the three de facto parties that are relevant to us and the ones we need to be negotiating around. Republicans aren't a party. That's, as far as I'm concerned, they're upholding the principles of well-worn neo-Confederate ideals, and they're completely irrelevant to moving forward in America. They're not irrelevant in terms of their existence because they are a problem. We need to confront them, but they represent a smaller and smaller group of Americans. I think we ought to be proud of the fact that we, on our side, are the ones that are engaged, that represent more Americans. Those three entities I named represent more Americans than the Republican Party. So on paper, okay, we can say a four-party system, but the three are on that left spectrum. And so I think we ought to continue to struggle around unity, deal with issues need to be dealt with, but don't hurt ourselves, shoot ourselves in the foot, fall out. I think it would be better for us to argue and fuss and fight with Hillary Clinton than it would be to argue and fuss and fight with Donald Trump in the White House.
Oh, I think without a doubt. I mean, the point is that we could actually, with a Democratic president, even one who's issue sets are, you know, maybe to the right and perspective is to the right and is beholden in many respects to big money. I mean, there was a piece in the Times today about the funders sort of feeling like, okay, now we we don't have to slink around so much anymore.
It's out there.
And which I found to be interesting and obviously, I mean, to be expected to a certain extent. Yeah. I mean, this is a long-term problem with the money. And I think, I don't know, one of the things that frustrates me about seeing the protests here, some of them, I should say, you know, like last night, apparently, there was a protest in the media tent. Susan Sarandon, Rosario Dawson, Danny Glover, a couple others, people who I generally respect, talking about how Nina Hunt was prevented from speaking.
Yeah, Nina Turner, right.
Nina Turner, sorry. My understanding is that the DNC or the Clinton people were worried. Mm-hmm. Nina Turner getting up there and I guess announcing Bernie Sanders' nomination.
Right, right.
And so they ended up going with Tulsi Gabbard.
Right, right.
And, you know, they're having a protest about Turner not getting that speaking slot. And it just, you know, at one point it's like we're so far removed from what the point of the Sanders campaign was. Like, instead of putting your energy in talking about who was personally slighted, who didn't get the credentials, who didn't get the speaking slot, do it on TPP, do it on a broader, you know, single-payer healthcare, whatever it is. But stay with the issues.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, I think you're right. My understanding of the kerfuffle is that they had agreed at first that Nina and Tulsi would both put Bernie's name in nomination. At the last minute, the Clinton campaign decided they just didn't want Nina up there, and it got somewhat personalized, and I think that was the problem. And I think all of those individuals, including me, I think Nina's a rising star.
I do, too.
You know, I was hurt for her. She was very, very hurt. We talked about it. But I also agree with you, and I said to Nina, I said, Nina, you are a rising star. You have your own cachet. You know, we need to continue to build this movement. You're somebody who can build it. And I said, you know, don't even let this thing with the Clintons, because, you know, sometimes your enemy, Sam, can pull you down into that. They set
Absolutely.
You up. And then you're caught in that whirlwind. Well, I just didn't get a speaking slot. I said, Nina, you know, you're even above that. If anything, if the Clintons were smart, and this is the argument, I think people are trying to make this argument to them, you know, they ought to be trying to pull Nina in as much as they were trying to pull Bernie in, frankly. And I just don't think, and I don't even know it was the Clintons. It's my understanding that it was more some of the underlings. You know, staff can be as big of a problem as the,
right.
as the candidate.
Right.
And they just, you know, they just didn't realize the magnitude of her persona. And I suggested, you know, to those involved, and even there's some people, I know Donna Brazile's been in touch with Nina, and I think there are those who are trying to look out for her and be sure she's involved. So that should resolve that in terms of what you're talking about, the importance of that, Nina's role, her future in this party, or her future in this movement. We can get to that. But that is not something that you sacrifice, as I said to her, or you make a greater priority than some of the issues that are out there. Now, speaking of the TPP, I had Terry McAuliffe sit down with me yesterday, and that's the first thing I hit him with.
Yeah.
I said, so, dude, you run around saying that she's going to... And by yesterday afternoon, they got to him, and he was cleaning that up. Like,
because, I saw him on day two. He was... He was cleaning it up, but he wasn't walking. I don't know how far he was walking it back.
Yeah. Well, he what he said to me, and I think this is as far as he walked it back, was that she would try to get a better deal.
Now, here's something I don't understand. How's that going to happen?
Right.
You have the 17 countries have signed off on it.
Yeah.
My understanding is the U.S. can't unilaterally change anything.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, of significance, how could they?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I mean, how does that work exactly?
I don't know that you can.
And they're going to put it in a different font when they pass it here?
That's a good question. We should ask him that. I don't know what he meant. But then, I honestly was slightly distracted.
What do you think he's doing when he does that? I've asked this question of a couple of people, because it's not like, you know, Austin Goolsbee going up to Canada and saying, like, hey, you know, that stuff Obama's saying about NAFTA. Yeah, you don't have to worry about that. I mean, he's doing this very publicly.
Yeah, I don't know, because, and that's what I was about to say. I tell you, Sam, what was a little awkward about it, and I'm not going to name this person, but there was another very, very, very high-ranking...
Initials.
Democratic Party official who saw me at the table with Terry, came over to observe what he was saying. A very high official, very close to the Clintons, and by the time we were done... this person had to be separated from him. So I don't know whether, and that led me to believe that he's just doing his own thing, running his mouth. I'm not sure. But this other person, like somebody had to stand in between this person and him. So I'm not really sure what he's doing and what the purpose of that is, because it's definitely not making her more endearing. It's not helping her. He wouldn't be where he is without them, so I don't understand what purpose he's serving by putting that. Even if it's true, I'm not sure how he's helping
that
her.
That seems the last thing you would do if it's true.
Yeah, to put her out there. So, I don't know. People just talk and run their mouths, and, you know, like there are a lot of very... This is, folks who are listening, I know we're at the Democratic Convention, and, you know, see all these... But there are a lot of human beings here, and human beings are terribly flawed. That's all. I see that more and more every day. And that's what...
It must be his way of trying to raise money. I honestly think that it's like him putting it out there and hoping that, like... It makes his approach... I mean, this guy's a big money raiser, Terry McAuliffe. I mean, that's how he made his bones, right?
Yeah.
And it's got to be some technique he has of going to the people who are sitting up in the skyboxes up here and saying, like, look, you heard me.
Well,
I wouldn't be saying it if it wasn't true.
I couldn't even hear the rest of the interview because we were so distracted that this other person was about to literally leap across the table. I'm sitting there, like, waiting on something to happen. And so we got out of it. But I think you're right. I think the
Did
other...
Did you tell your listeners who it was?
No. I'm not... I can't... I shouldn't do that. It was very... I mean, I'm already in WikiLeaks in the emails. I don't want to be in nothing else, so I'm not even going to... They already were jumping on me in the emails, but...
How did you get caught up in the emails?
I've been playing it straight on my show. You know, we have a lot of Bernie support, and my audience is literally 50-50, and that's a constituency I serve. One of Bernie's high-ranking officials came on the show at the time. They accused the DNC of money laundering. So I'm going to be a journalist, Sam. And I said, I had that individual on. Then I called Debbie Wasserman Schultz's people. Couldn't get through. But we're not strangers. Couldn't get through. So I had my program director, who happened to need to reach out to them, said, you know, let them know. Debbie needs to come on.
Oh, yes.
Yeah,
yes,
Debbie
yes,
needs to come on and respond to this. Yeah, right. So he reaches out to Debbie's people. And, it's you know, this is bizarre, man. People decline interviews all the time, so we're too busy, we can't do it. I mean, and that's the end of it.
Right.
But instead, you know, and not to our knowledge until the WikiLeaks came out, there's a whole thread of 14, 15 emails debating about whether or not she should come on my show, which so I'm kind of flattered to know I'm that important. It was all those deliberations. Then they took shots at my program director, David Guggenheim,
Guggenheim was a Bernie bro.
Right, yeah.
And
now, it's interesting, they didn't call me a Bernie bro. But what they did do was, you know, question why I wouldn't accept a surrogate. And I'm like, I know you, Sam. And so it's like me, well, Mark, I'm not coming. I'm going to send somebody else. But I know I'm going to wait for you. So I said, no, I want to talk to her. I don't want to talk to Louis Miranda.
Right.
And they kept pushing it. And I'm glad I declined, because Louis was saying all this stuff behind our back anyway. Now that I know it, I love to talk to Louis now in person. Like, what's up, dude? You know, what's up with you? So, you know, but it showed how dumb they were, Sam.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, there's a lot, like a high level of incompetence.
But listen, if you know, if I know you, you know me. It's not like none of us know each other.
Right.
I don't have a history of ambushing guests. You don't have a history. So why would anybody say, either one of us, oh, I don't know, don't go on there because we might get ambushed. But then you're going to run around and show up on Fox and every place else where you do get ambushed.
Right.
But you're going to run from people like us who are in the family and are serving your constituents?
You know, even if... Even if David Guggenheim was a Bernie bro, which I think, you know, it's hilarious, I think, on some level. I mean, I know David a little bit, too.
Yeah, yeah.
But even if that was the case, like, and what? Like, you can't answer these questions? Like, you know, like, honestly, like, are you really not capable of answering these questions? That there should be an email chain of saying, like, hey, we have a problem here. We can't go on radio and answer a simple question.
And answer. Or even, look, you can always choose to go on radio and tell your side of the story and deny it. Even that, that's a position.
Of course.
No, Mark, we're not money laundering at all. That's it. I mean, this is just a question of getting on the record, even giving you an opportunity, which is what we're supposed to do as journalists. Right. We're not supposed to take one side and say that's the gospel. We're supposed to give the other side an opportunity to respond. We need to give Russia an opportunity to respond as to whether or not they do what Trump says. I mean, that's a fair question. So, no, I don't quite get it. But I'm going to say this in fairness, though. You know, a lot of these political and staff elitism is not, I just have to be fair about it, is not exclusive to the Clintons. The same we don't have, we're not in WikiLeaks, we haven't hacked into the Bernie Sanders emails, but there was a lot of vacillation, even though Bernie has been on our channel for over a decade on Tom Hartman's show. Once Bernie ran for office, he would not come on Tom, he would never come on my show. So it's not like I can sit up and say, well, I'm mad at them for not letting Debbie come on, when the Sanders campaign was doing the same thing. It's a lot of overthinking.
Very, very protective. Yeah.
It's too much overthinking.
Very, very protective.
And it's a little insulting to me because, again, I don't have a history of jamming people up.
Right.
You know, so, you know, it's silly. But as I said, folks, humanity is everywhere. And we're dealing with flawed human beings, you know.
When do you think Debbie Wasserman Schultz comes out of the witness protection program?
I don't know. This has been very poorly handled. She handled it very, very poorly. And really, the chair of the DNC shouldn't even be in the news. I mean, I don't know if it needs to be as extreme as Tim Kaine, who nobody was so behind the scenes, nobody even knew
he
was chair of the DNC. People had to be reminded that. He didn't even mention it last night.
No. Well, and I think part of it, frankly, is that he was a big money guy.
That's exactly what
he was. And a big corporate money guy.
Yeah, I talked to David Dan yesterday. I think, because I saw you talking to David, I think that's why they picked him, obviously. He's the money guy.
I think that was definitely a plus. I mean, I think there's value in Virginia. I think there's value in his story. He's like the Joe Biden surrogate.
He's more plain and aw shucks than even Joe Biden, man.
I mean,
we saw that last night. Like, this dude, but I'm going to tell you, Sam, I mean, we just have to deal with what's real. People in Virginia worship Tim Kaine.
Yeah.
I mean, look, I can't fight every battle. So I was like, well, I don't know. I don't see the excitement. Even my relatives live in Virginia. They called him, cursed me out. Mark, don't you say anything about Tim Kaine. Tim Kaine's a great guy. I mean, after a while, I mean, I'm not going to get in that fight. People in Virginia, black, white, Latin, he is a hero. And maybe it's because he's that down to earth, that accessible.
He seems extremely retail.
So that's
got a little lost, I felt like, on that stage, to be honest with you.
Yeah,
he just was, he's not, there's not a high charisma quotient.
But
there.
It's like that's part of the formula. And for whatever reason, it works for him and works in Virginia. You know, they would have booed us off stage. You and I couldn't have done that, but that's Tim.
Right.
And I mean, I would have picked Warren. I would have even considered Tom Perez.
I don't mean to be
ugly, but why get the white dude who speaks Spanish? Why not get an authentic Latino? But again, there are calculations.
I think there's two answers to that. Well, three, I think. One is considerably more progressive.
Yeah.
And that dovetails with the money thing.
Yeah.
Like, you know, you have to signal to your corporate benefactors and sponsors. I think also they probably had some concern of, like, are we ready for two firsts in one ticket?
I bet you there's
a little bit of that, too.
Yeah.
And also, you know, you have somebody who has a history of governing and running you know, the guy's run for three different offices.
Right, right. And that's another thing. You know, people who are probably less idealistic and more pragmatic than you and I say, Mark, you know, he actually has governing experience. He knows how to run things. And right. You don't care about that. I said, well, I wouldn't say I don't care about it. I don't think these others don't have that experience. But look, they have mathematical calculations that we're not privy to. And we know how the Clintons are. They get into the wonkishness. They obviously have some information that tells him, this is the guy we need to get Virginia, keep it blue, and get this math done. We know it wasn't just about, we get along, he's a cool guy, he's friendly, he's cute. You know, this is the math on this. And it's the money. Last thing I'll say is that on the money issue, we know the Clintons and their attraction to money, that being what it is. We also know that Citizens United, you know, really boxes us into this position. Yeah. Even if Bernie was a nominee, we would have to have, you know, serious negotiation about what to do money, because it's hard to compete when everybody else is giving one side of the money, getting all the money, and our side isn't getting any. So here's the key. When she's elected, and I think she'll win, Trump's crazy. This is the second DNC break-in, by the way. It's just this one is more sophisticated. They're breaking the building anymore. Once she's elected, we hold her to the fire by seeing what she does to reverse Citizens United. Then we're back in the game of holding everybody accountable across the board and getting this money out.
Mark Thompson, thank you so much. I really
appreciate it. Enjoy the show. Keep up the great work, man.
Thank you, man.
We need to do more together, all right?
Yeah.
Love you, buddy.
Appreciate it.
Okay, take care.
Okay. I know we're a couple minutes late, but joining me right now will be Kathleen Kennedy Townsend. She is making her way over here to sit down.
How are you doing?
I'm doing very well. We're live right now. And joining me here at the convention, Kathleen Kennedy Townsend, former Lieutenant Governor of Maryland, and now a research professor?
At Georgetown.
At Georgetown. And thank you so much for joining us.
It's
really
good to be here.
So, you know, you just had a really interesting piece in the New York Times that I was just reading earlier.
Did you?
It brought up a really interesting issue that I hadn't really contemplated that much about your aunt. When your aunt, Eunice Kennedy Shriver, passed away, people started asking, or maybe they had asked prior to this, why she had never run for president when three of her brothers did. I mean, you are the only female Kennedy, right? Who has run for office.
I am.
What of that?
Well, you know what I just to tell your listeners what I wrote in the piece is that the United States is one of the few countries in the world in which we don't have a female archetype of power. You know, most countries have had queens, so they've seen a queens that have been powerful.
Do you need to...
Other countries have had, and because America is a Judeo-Christian world, our God is male. Whereas, you know, you think of India, they have 70 million gods, and half the gods are female. Because if we were a Catholic country, at least in Latin America, you have Queen Mary, you know, and you have all these saints where you have Joan of Arc. So at least you have these saints that you have powerful women. But we don't have, or our holidays are all sort of male-oriented. Martin Luther King, or the President's Day, or Memorial Day, or Veterans Day, which are traditional male. And Mother's Day is really not a powerful woman.
Right.
I mean, she's a wonderful woman, or even... So we don't see... I've gone and spoken to so many audiences about women taking power seriously, and I ask women... And that's the title of my speech. And I asked women to close their eyes and think of somebody powerful. And 70% of the audience always think of a male. So we don't have a picture of a woman who's in power. It's just hard for us. So when I say, why didn't my aunt run for president? She probably didn't see herself as president. And nobody around her saw herself as president. Because It's guys who became presidents,
right.
not women.
Right.
And I say myself, people said, oh, you probably always thought of yourself running for office. I said, no, never occurred to me till the women's movement. You know, I went to Harvard. I didn't have a single woman teacher.
Wow.
You know, I was the class of 73, and they were all males. I applied for a government class, and I wasn't accepted. It was guys that got accepted to the government class. Interesting.
That's pretty amazing.
No,
that
I know.
As a Kennedy,
I know.
You're not accepted
to the government
yes.
class. No, I know. This is not itty poo Kathleen, but it just is explaining
that the context.
That the context of 30 years ago, or this now 40 years ago, was so much that males are in charge. And so I give Hillary Clinton enormous credit for doing what she was able to do, what she's been able to do, and why it's so difficult, because she's being criticized as a woman on one hand, and then just as a regular candidate
right.
on the other, and how much she has to break through to create a whole new archetype. I mean, creating archetypes usually take, you know, the Iliad and the Odyssey to be, you know, they created archetypes, or the Bible creates archetypes. I mean, it's a huge mythological effort to do this, and she's having to do it in a generation.
And you know, and to a certain extent, I think like that context has seemed, at least I think, to have changed so radically over the past maybe 20 years or so, that it explains the why younger women don't seem to have the same appreciation.
Well, younger women, I think the reason younger women don't see it is because if you look at young, first of all, many younger women go to college, in which 60% of all colleges now are 60% women. So they dominate the classes. They become the president of the class. Thanks to Title IX, they have as many sports as men. So they don't see the problem. And they have not faced, as their older sisters have had to face, or what happens when they have a child. And in 20 years, I mean, I have four daughters, and they describe how they weren't feminists when they were in college, and then suddenly they get pregnant. And they thought, oh my gosh, who's going to stay home and take care of the baby?
Right.
How am I still going to work? Do I drop out of the workforce? The cost of childcare is almost the cost of my salary.
Right.
And those are huge. Do I stay in the workforce? Do I pay for childcare? And suddenly, unless you're really, really, you know, like really, really rich, these are huge trade-offs that many women, when they're just young, don't even know exist.
Right. And even to the extent, I mean, we should also say, that it's the same with young men, although I would also argue that older men don't necessarily have a full appreciation of it either. It's not a generational
right.
issue there. But
actually,
it's also like even the women today who are faced with that dilemma. I mean, it's a dilemma.
Yeah.
Right. Like at least there's. And that cuts both ways. Sometimes life is a little bit easier when, you know, things are dictated to you. But respects.
Or you know what you're supposed to do.
Right.
And now the question is, what should you do?
You know, one of the things that it strikes me about Hillary Clinton that I feel like is that there was virtually no way for a woman of her generation to get to the level of where she has been to. Without it starting or going through a marriage on some level. I mean, right? I mean, like, in this country anyways, I mean...
Well, let's see. It was interesting. Barbara Mikulski did become a senator in 86.
Right.
And she was unmarried. So she did it. Dianne Feinstein got where she was. She was married, but somebody was killed in front of her. So there was enormous tragedy. It's pretty hard. The advantage that Hillary has had being married is that she has seen all levels of government in many different places. I mean, what I loved about Bill Clinton's speech is she's worked in so many parts of the country, in so many areas. So she really knows this country, and as Secretary of State, she knows the world. I mean, it's really true. Who else has had that level?
No, I mean, I think
breadth,
you know,
of experience.
You know, like
it's stunning.
George Herbert Walker Bush probably saw things from a couple of different angles before he was president, the CIA director. I guess I don't get the sense necessarily that he had the breadth of exposure to different types of people that Clinton has had. But at least in terms of the presidency itself, he saw from a couple of different angles. But it's hard to come up with anybody.
But he probably didn't deal with women, children, youth, and families.
Absolutely not, I would argue.
Yes, right. Or poverty.
Or poverty, yes. I mean he lived a pretty rarefied life on.
Totally.
Give me your sense of, I mean, you look at the overall picture of how the convention is going. Are you seeing things that, like, you wish were addressed? Or you know, when you anticipate, like, okay, I imagine in your mind, before the convention starts, you have a sense of, like, they've got to do A, they've got to do B, and they've got to do C. What was A, B, C, and have they accomplished that?
Yeah, I think they did. I think last night they did a very good job of reaching out to the police. You know, I think I knew that they were going to reach out to the police, the people who have been killed by police. But I think they also did a good job of saying the police too feel the same fear, and I thought that was very important to do. I thought that they also did a very good job last night to reach out to the military. You know, Joe Biden, Tim Kaine, I thought did a very good job. The naval officer, the Navy, the Admiral, I thought he did a terrific job. So I thought it was very important to show that there are a lot of military chops on the Democratic side, which has traditionally been the Democratic weakness. But against Donald Trump, I thought that the foreign policy and the strength of the military is on our side. So I thought that was critically important. What I'm anxious to keep showing is that we've got, I think we've shown very well, we have diversity, we're doing well with women, we're doing well with diversity. I want to win, you know, blue collar whites. I want to show that we're the party of people who are working with their hands, and we're going to make sure that they've got a good wage, a way up for themselves, and a place for their kids.
That strikes me as we're seeing a lot of, it's very urgent to not elect Donald Trump.
Yeah.
I don't feel like we're seeing that much of, like, here's a proactive reason to vote for Democrats, or here is an overarching ideological difference that we have with Republicans. That seems to be out the window. Do you think that's going to be problematic down the road? I mean, I understand the urgency of not electing Donald Trump, but, you know, I'm not sure I buy the gulf between Donald Trump and Ted Cruz is that huge. But
yeah, it was probably more anti-Trump. And I think that Hillary has so many policies, as you know.
Right.
So I think that we have to show that we're the party of opportunity, and that we are not just opportunity, we will make it happen.
Indeed. Well, Kathleen Kennedy Townsend, professor at the Center for Retirement Initiatives at Georgetown University, thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate
it. Great to be with you.
Thank you.
Take care.
All right, folks, we're going to head into the fun half. We'll take a little bit of break. Oh, not at all. And forgive us the... The music. How loud is that music coming down the...
It's a really funny contrast with the conversation on archetypes.
Yeah, well, it's not a contrast.
It's ironic.
Actually.
It's, well, yes.
Katy Perry.
Maybe a little downgrade
Eye
there.
Of the tiger and whatever.
I don't know
she's
if
saying.
She's elevating the conversation. That was really interesting.
I think that could actually be Katy Perry.
Oh, you think really they would have her out that early?
Well, I think they're doing a sound check.
Oh, they're doing a sound check.
Oh my God, seriously?
She's awful.
She has a huge Twitter following, and she
really.
Holy cow! Wait
I
a
thought
second.
She only
is
had
that,
like a couple
Katy
of people
Perry?
On Twitter.
I feel like I should take a picture.
Yeah, take a picture
Mila.
Of Katy Perry for Mila.
All right,
do it.
Go play the music. I'll be back in a second.
We're going to the fun half.
Yeah, we're going to the
okay.
fun half.
All right. All right,
Katy
get a picture
Perry
from
says
Mila.
Positive things
I will.
For
be right back.
Girls. She
right.
does.
Yeah, have a bad breakup and go kill Afghans to improve your self-esteem. That's great.